This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Policemen displaying their brute power to a group of villagers and fisher folk in Sompeta in Andhra Pradesh's Srikakulam district. The locals were protesting against the setting up of a thermal power plant in the area. With over 3,000 villagers from surrounding villages descending on the foundation laying ceremony of the plant, despite prohibitory orders in place, the police opened fire.
Carry on my wayward son, there'll be peace when you are done. Lay your weary head to rest, don't you cry no more.
I'm hoping my bank account will still be open next Monday. Most of us are trying to get through just the next week. Half of us can't live without the next paycheck. Will Europe survive? I don't know. Despite the smiling faces of banking experts on TV, too many signs say, "Welcome to the Great Depression." And some 1930s-style slowdown isn't the worst thing that I could imagine happening. In the constant drumbeat of these down times, it's pretty hard to care about what is happening somewhere else, in places we don't ever hear about. That climate stuff, that's years away, too, except for the weird weather this year.
Once I rose above the noise and confusion, just to get a glimpse beyond this illusion, I was soaring ever higher.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm going to try and convince you that a relatively small island on the other side of your world can break the climate wide open. Strange fires in Asia helped start the hottest year on record before 2010. They are burning again right now, blanketing Southeast Asia with acrid smoke and loading up the atmosphere with a brand new burst of carbon, possibly as large as the exhaust from every car on Earth. That same tropical forest blaze, larger than the Amazon fires, is on Sumatra, which is part of Indonesia. What happens there could determine whether we make it as a civilization or eventually as a species. Don't believe me? Keep listening. We'll hear from Dr. Florian Siegert in Munich, Germany, who can see it all from space. Indonesia is also the world's second largest coal exporter. That feeds the second largest coal power race on the planet, and I'm talking about India, where 173 new coal-fired power plants have been approved this year alone. It's a mania that is already failing in its own way, even while it destroys so much. Peasants and fishermen have been killed by police, protecting coal plant sites from protests. The scale of ecological damage is amazing, the threat to our climate frightening. We don't hear anything about this, as we pray our jobs will keep going or worry we'll never get another job. But we'll talk with Indian electricity expert Shankar Sharma to get the real picture. You'll hear the sounds of protests and learn how this global coal resistance is hooking up Indian peasants to the poorest people in Appalachia, USA. We won't have to wait until 2050 to find out what happens if the coal rush plays out. As Steve Connor, the science editor for Britain's Independent newspaper, wrote on July 5th, pollution from the one new coal plant a week in China has hidden the true meaning, the warming impact, in a phenomenon known as global dimming. The new Indian coal plants, growing like mushrooms along the coast, will do the same for a few years. But that protective smog lasts only a few years at most and could clear in less than a month if production suddenly stopped, perhaps after a solar flare or a really big economic breakdown or riots. When the wisps of smoke, as James Lovelock called them, when they're washed out of the atmosphere, we could experience a severe heating event. This could manifest locally or globally. No one knows. I asked Dr. Florian Siegert about this and whether the peat fires of Indonesia in 1997 helped power the planet into the record-breaking heat of 1998. Our guest is Professor Florian Siegert from the GeoBio Center of the Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich. His research specializes in the use of satellite sensors to monitor changes on the ground, especially in tropical and subtropical forests. Currently, he is funded by the European Commission for a project called Red Flame. There's two D's in that red, and it's Fast Logging Assessment and Monitoring Environment, a tool to detect logging and fire damage. Dr. Siegert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, hello.
Before we discuss the specifics of Indonesia, how would you describe your work to an ordinary person?
We use satellites to monitor the Earth's surface and how humans impact forests and other types of vegetation. So we monitor changes of the Earth's surface.
How is that possible? How can you do that?
So in the past 20 years, maybe around 100 satellites have been launched by various countries, and we use maybe 10 or 15 of them. So satellites which make photographs of the Earth's surface, let's say every month or every week, and also radar satellites. Radar is a specific wavelength which penetrates clouds, so we can get weather-independent pictures and images from the Earth's surface.
Well, I'm calling you today, Professor Siegert, because Indonesia really came into world climate consciousness due to major fires that started in 1997 and they continued into 1998. It was difficult to miss. Choking smoke blew over Malaysia, Singapore, much of Southeast Asia. And my first question is, do you think that smoke would have had at first a bit of a cooling effect like the Asian brown cloud discovered by Professor V. Ramanathan at the Scripps Institute?
So I'm not a climate specialist, but what I know from reading from the literature, true, it had a very small cooling effect.
All right, but really what we were interested in is the heating. What can you tell us about the climate impact of that major Indonesian forest fire?
Yeah, so we were doing work in Indonesia the years before, ecological work, and at that time then in 1997, huge fires occurred in Indonesia, and we started to investigate how could this happen and also the extent of these fires. So we started in 1998 some remote sensing work using, as I said, radar satellites and optical satellites to map the burned area and also the type of vegetation which has been burned. And at that time we could show that the major contribution to carbon dioxide emissions came from peat fires. So peat is like a swamp ecosystem. It's a huge pile of biomass, which is not decomposed because it's waterlogged. And at that time, the government of Indonesia started to dig irrigation canals into these peat swamps, peat swamp forests. And when the El Nino weather condition came in 1997, all these peats were drained severely through these canals, and then the fires, which were ignited by, let's say, farmers or people who wanted to clear land for plantations, they came out of control and burned huge areas of land, and especially peat land.
And what would that have done for carbon emissions?
So, yeah, at that time we published, then, so in 2001, we published a paper showing how much carbon dioxide has been released by this single event. And it was very, very significant. It was 15% of the total emissions of all human activity at that year. So only from peat fires in Indonesia, not all the forest fires. There were much more fires in 1997 in Amazonia and other parts of the world. due to the extended drought. But from the peat fires alone, so Indonesia contributed in 1997 15% of the total emissions by burning fossil fuels and whatever, gas, everything.
That is an amazing number. As you know, 1998 was declared the hottest year on record, at least until 2010.
Yeah.
Is it possible that the forest and peat fires created a burst of carbon that helped to make that year hotter? I know there were other problems like El Nino, but could this have contributed to a hotter year?
Probably. So at least the carbon dioxide measurements at the Mauna Loa in Hawaii show a doubling of the carbon dioxide emissions in that specific year, in 1997. So you have an every year you have an increase in carbon dioxide, but in that year we had a doubling of the increase. So it was measured directly, the carbon dioxide concentration.
And I realize, again, you're not a climate scientist, but my question is there a lag time between when carbon or even methane goes up into the atmosphere and we feel a heating, or does it happen more or less right away?
I don't know. I would guess if you measure higher carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere, then you have more heat trapped in the atmosphere as soon as you measure it. But there are complex processes. Yeah? The oceans absorb carbon dioxide, vegetation is growing, and so on. So nobody can measure all these processes, but they are models for that. But I guess that once, if you measure the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you have the heating.
It makes sense. Well, once again, right now, in early September 2011, smoke from fires on the island of Sumatra has reached Malaysia and Singapore, and Singapore is talking about sending firefighters, and Indonesia is talking about seeding the clouds to make rain. What do you know about what is going on there?
Well, we have right now several people working there, doing studies, measurements of biomass, of peat depths, and so on. And we also do LIDAR flights, so with airplanes we fly a LIDAR instrument to measure the carbon stock in trees, in forests, and to really get better figures about the dimension and the role of these Indonesian fires. So they are almost every year, but in El Nino years they are much stronger, more fires, more haze, and so on. And this year, 2011, is the first year after two La Nina years, which were very wet in Indonesia, and it was hard to start a fire for land clearing. So people have now a lot to do because they couldn't do it the past 2 years. So that's why we have many fires in 2011 again.
So these fires are directly related to logging and land clearing? They're caused by humans?
Yes, of course. So I haven't read anything about fire by lightning, so nobody has written on that, and I never observed it. So usually in the very wet tropics, like in Indonesia, lightning is always comes with water, with rain. And so to our experience, and this is now more than 15 years, almost 100% of the fires are started by humans. On the one hand, small-scale farmers, they clear land, maybe 1 to 5 hectares for their personal production. But more important are the fires from investors and plantation companies like oil palm and so on, who use fire to clear the land for the establishment of the plantation.
So with your satellite research tools, can you see the conversion of tropical forests to, say, palm oil plantations? And if so, what have you found?
Yes, so we monitor some regions in Indonesia regularly. And we see, of course, the expansion of the palm oil business, especially with the biofuel hype. So this really accelerated again the palm oil expansion in the past 2 years.
It's an odd spin-off, really, from green thinking. In fact, I heard that some of the palm oil was going to Holland to offset other types of fuel. This is a biofuel, so...
Yeah, it's crazy.
It isn't that green if it causes more climate change.
Yeah, so we really could show that if palm oil is established on peat, you release 5 to 10 times more carbon dioxide then you save by establishing the oil palm and using the oil palm for 25 years period. So you release five times or up to 10 times more. And you must know that most plantations are now established in peatlands because these are the only uninhabited land in Indonesia. Yeah? Indonesia has 240 million inhabitants. And so all the good soils are settled by people. And peat soils are poor soils. They are still forest covered. And this is the place where the new plantations become established.
Well, that's sort of expanding humanity. The other thing that confuses me about peat is usually when I think of that, it's Ireland or in Scandinavia or Canada. Why are we talking about peat in Indonesia and how much of it is there?
It's absolutely significant. So Indonesia has 70% of all tropical peatlands, but probably there are much more peatlands in Amazonia and Africa, not yet discovered and characterized. So Indonesia has 70%, and the boreal, so peat in boreal in colder regions, is from the area the much bigger in size, but the volume, so the peat is much thicker in Indonesia, up to 15 meters thick, a pile of 15 meters of biomass. So it's an absolutely significant portion of the total peat on Earth is located in Indonesia.
And once peat starts burning, it's very, very difficult to put it out.
Almost impossible because no water is available. You would need helicopters and so on, and this equipment is not available in Indonesia. So, and it's also too expensive.
And then we're also losing some biomass and some carbon into the air from just logging tropical rainforests in Indonesia. Do you know how much Indonesian forest is being lost? Can we compare it to the Amazon?
Very difficult because there are no nationwide satellite monitoring systems working. So we work only on smaller areas, yeah, let's say hotspots, but nobody has a figure for the whole country except FAO. And FAO has done the last, but they do it using country statistics and so on, yeah? So not really remote sensing, and if so, only with a sampling scheme. So nobody has a real figure, but at least in Indonesia and Southeast Asia, there are the highest rates of deforestation, higher than in Amazonia and Africa.
Why is the European Union monitoring forest destruction on the other side of the world?
Yeah, I think so. Timber, so Europe is still buying a lot of timber from tropical countries, and there's concern about that we should stop that to protect these forests because of their role in climate change, so carbon storage and so on. And so I think the EU is financing research to find out more about the dimension of logging and so on.
And looking at what we could be doing about this forest damage in order to prevent climate change in a country like Indonesia, are there people working on policies? Do you have ideas on what we could do to slow this down at least?
Yes, so currently in the World Climate Negotiations, there's a scheme called REDD, Reduced Emissions by Avoided Deforestation in Developing Countries. So this is a financing scheme where rich countries pay poor countries to preserve their forests.
And it seems to me, as we wrap up, that we're not necessarily talking about big evil corporations here. You're talking also about small people just clearing the land in order to live. Is that the case?
No, I would say the dimension, so more fires are ignited by farmers, but the severe fires, so the fires with large-scale impact, are started by companies. So I would say much more destruction is done by companies and investors than by small farmers.
Well, thank you so much. We have been speaking with Professor Florian Siegert. He's from the GeoBio Center of the Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich. Dr. Siegert specializes in satellite monitoring of land changes in tropical and subtropical countries. Professor, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you.
I am Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Just to quickly review, Indonesia is burning off tropical forests faster than anywhere else on Earth, including the Amazon. This releases vast amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. Even so, the carbon emissions from Indonesian peat fires is even greater. Scientists calculated Indonesian peat fires amounted to 15% of all greenhouse gas emissions caused by human activity in 1997. 15%. A huge burst of carbon that was measured immediately at the Hawaii Measuring Station. The rate of increase of CO2 doubled at the Mauna Loa Station that year. 1998 was the hottest year on record until 2010, you know that. This single peat fire bomb in 1997 may have triggered the continuing increase of global warming gases around the world from other natural sources. Think about that. And research at the University of Exeter, led by Dr. Sebastian Wiesorek and Dr. Peter Ashwin, suggests that as global temperatures rise, some peat can spontaneously catch fire, like an overheated compost pile. We don't know when or if that will happen. Although up to a third of carbon dioxide has been grabbed by the ocean, the impact of carbon bursts from peat fires is more or less immediate. The greenhouse effect does not wait for years or decades. The existing carbon raises temperatures immediately, except for any temporary cooling effects from the smoke. There is more tropical peat in the Amazon of South America and in Africa, but we think Indonesia has the most by volume, up to 50 meters or 164 feet deep. If the peat in the northern permafrost thaws, dries, I'm talking about Canada and Russia and Scandinavia, and then it burns, a major extinction event is inevitable. That hasn't started happening too much, but we have had reports of peat fires in the north. More carbon is being released from forest fires in Indonesia and Southeast Asia than in the Amazon. Hardly anyone knows this. There's no campaign comparable to saving the Amazon. The Indonesian peat fires are largely caused by corporations and foreign investors. Yes, there are some small farmers clearing, but the big fires, the ones that really put the carbon up there, come from foreign investors. Some peat forests have been drained and burned for palm oil plantations. That is supposed to create a so-called green biofuel. Some of it sold in Europe, claiming to help the climate. In reality, when we remember Indonesia, palm oil from peatlands is among the most climate-damaging fuels on Earth. Palm oil biofuel taken from cleared peatlands releases 5 to 10 times more carbon dioxide than the fuel actually burned in the car or the power plant. This project is dangerously insane. The peat fires are back in 2011, in mid-September. The Indonesian government acknowledged 1,200 hotspots on their island of Sumatra. Thick smoke blankets Sumatra and pollutes Singapore and Malaysia to the east. In desperation, Indonesia is trying to create rain. There are complaints from the government of Singapore. There is no other way to put the peat fires out. Hundreds more fires have broken out on the nearby Kalimantan area, which is Indonesia's part of Borneo. By the way, that's a new name to learn, Kalimantan. Forests are being burned there to clear the land for more and more open-pit coal mines. A UN study in 2005 claimed Indonesia is the world's third-largest emitter of greenhouse gases. The government of Indonesia disputes this and protested. Since there is no true country-by-country measurement of emissions, I can't believe that, but there isn't, beyond the untrustworthy figures given by national governments now and then, we really can't tell. We do know this. On top of those humongous peat fires and record-breaking burning of other tropical forests and deforestation in Indonesia, that country provides enough coal carbon to reach a high rating among world polluters. This is information you need to know. If the latest flooding from extreme precipitation events missed your area, lucky you. Maybe drought hasn't burned away your local agriculture yet. Maybe the freaky summer beach weather in early fall is really fun. But we are only partway there. I still hope to persuade everyone that on this small planet, no matter what the headlines about the economic breakdown may be, events in Asia are set to destabilize the climate for thousands of years. Indonesia is the second largest exporter of coal in the world. Russia trails far behind at number 3 with half the coal exports of Indonesia. In 1985, Indonesia mined 2 million tons of coal. By the year 2000, that was 233 million tons. In 2010, it was 320 million tons, with 380 million tons projected for 2011. Indonesia depends on coal power for its own growing industrial base. In 2008, Indonesia burned 79 million tons of coal, mostly to produce electricity, and exported 160 million tons, twice the domestic consumption. The country's lower-grade coal is only suitable for burning in power stations, so it is called thermal coal. Indonesia is the world's largest provider of seaborne coal to power stations. The government of Indonesia does not plan to cut back its carbon emissions to save the climate. Locally, Indonesia plans to expand coal as a source of energy from 17% to 33% by 2025. That includes replacing oil by liquefying coal, a horrible dirty way to get energy. The country has 35 new coal-fired power plants planned, but only half of them are being built so far, according to Greenpeace. The national energy policy of Indonesia is to double coal exports. The country has mostly lower-grade coal, as I said, and it burns less efficiently, and it throws out lots more carbon, and it's being almost used exclusively to fire electricity-generating plants. While there are plenty of coal ships running from Indonesia to China and Japan and every Asian country, the biggest customer is India. India will drink up the coal of Indonesia in a wild national dream to build hundreds more coal plants. Really, it's a dark nightmare. If the Indian coal plants become reality, life as we know it seems doomed. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let us learn about India and electricity with our next guest. I'll follow that with more coal activist news in India, our biggest hope at the moment. We've all heard about the wave of new coal plants opening in China and the damage they do to our atmosphere, but India is slated to become the world's most populous country in the future, and it's about to become the world's third or fourth largest emitter of greenhouse gases, and a lot of that comes from burning coal to make electric power, which they need. You and I take electricity for granted, but power has not yet reached up to 44% of Indian homes. People want it, but the government and private sector are struggling to cope with it. What happens there could determine whether glaciers and the ice caps melt. It's one of the factors in the world anyway. We are lucky to have an expert on the Indian power sector with us today. Shankar Sharma is an electrical engineer and well-known power professional for the past 30 years. He publishes widely and is visiting Washington, D.C., partly for the coming World Bank annual meetings. We caught up with Shankar Sharma in the offices of the Sierra Club. Mr. Sharma, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
People here complain if the power goes out for a few hours, yet millions of people in India have nothing to plug into. Why is electrification taking so long?
Well, the population, as you're comparing with Canada or even United States and India, on the other hand, they're entirely different. India, as you know, it's the second most populous nation in the world. Indian population is about 1.2 billion. The infrastructure development has not caught up with the requirement so far. Various agencies, including the government ones and the private ones, are trying their best, but because of the sheer population number, it is not going to be very easy to provide electricity to all of them in the existing model of demand-supply, where conventional power plants are the basis in most of the developed countries. So what's happening is the country is a diverse geographical nature. There are high mountains, there are deserts, there are marshy lands, the forests. Now, if we go along the existing model elsewhere, as in elsewhere in the world, like huge power plants in one center, and power goes to different parts of the country through that power network, that's where the problem is, because we have some inaccessible areas where the centralized power power plant cannot meet the requirement at an acceptable level. We have a hugely diverse or dispersed population in nooks and corners, and to extend the existing network or centralized network to nooks and corners has its own huge problems, economic, social, and environmental problems. So that's the reason, main reason why the country has not been able to provide electricity to all population. The 40% or 44% of the population you mentioned in your introductory remark that they don't have electricity, they're all such people in remote areas, or those people who have low concentration of population in a given area, and the state agencies or the private sector do not find them to be good customers, get paid and all that. So that's why they are not putting emphasis in providing electricity to such people. And all the power producers, including the state agencies, they are concentrating on the urban centers because that's where higher concentration of population is. That's how this 44%, all of them, invariably, they are in rural areas and a bit remote areas too.
I understand. Now, can you tell us, what role does coal play for electric power in that mix in India?
Unfortunately, the coal is playing a major role as of now. As of 30th June this year, the total installed capacity in the country was approximately 180,000 megawatts, the total installed power generating capacity, out of which about, 47% is coming from individual provincial states, about 32% coming from union government-owned power plants, and about 22% comes from the private sector power plants. Now, out of this 177,000 megawatts of installed capacity, coal forms about 55% of the installed capacity. So you can see coal has a major share all these years, but still it has not been able to address the problems fully.
I heard one new mega coal plant that was under construction was stopped recently, and another had to double prices to cover very big financial losses. Can you tell us what is going on in these shocking events in the coal industry?
Well, it is not just one. The entire coal industry in the country is facing a number of problems, basically because not enough thinking has gone into in planning them. The two mega power plants you referred to, one was on the east coast and the other was on the west coast of the country. Both of them are considered to be ultra-mega power project, means each of them would have an ultimate capacity in excess of 4,000 megawatts. They are considered to be some of the largest in the world. And what has happened was, since it requires huge amount of coal to burn to run those power plants, both these power plants initially thought that they would get all their coal requirement through import, importing the coal from Indonesia, South Africa, Australia especially. But these two particular plants, they wanted to rely on Indonesian coal supply. But what happened due to some changes in the coal export policy of Indonesia, they found that the coal import to these power plants would not be reliable. And also the cost would go up very steeply as compared to the parameters they took into consideration while planning the project. And the coal price seemed to be going up beyond 20 to 25%, and the reliability of coal supply also seemed to be under question. Because of that, these power plants have not been commissioned yet. They are in the initial stages of construction. One or two power generator units might have been commissioned in say, a few months' time, but for this problem. So because of all these uncertainties, those two power companies, they are asking for the government to revise the tariff at which they can sell the power, but the government is very hesitant, and the end consumers are not accepting the revised tariff because these two power projects, they entered into a sort of agreement at a given power tariff level for next 15, 20 years. Now, even before single unit of electricity generated, they want to revise the power supply upwards because of the coal problem, which the consumers are refusing to accept. So, keeping that in view, these power producers or the developers, they have hesitation to go ahead with the commissioning of the units.
If you have just tuned in, this is Radio EcoShock. I am your host, Alex Smith, talking about India, one of the fastest growing countries and the fastest growing sources of greenhouse gas emissions. Our guest is electricity expert Shankar Sharma. Mr. Sharma, I thought India had its own domestic coal supply. Why is it importing?
No, that is a misnomer. Say 10 or 15 years ago or even 20 years ago, People thought that India has abundant amount of coal supply. It used to be probably true from that perspective, say, 15 years ago. But since then, a large number of coal power plants have come up, which means they have opened a large number of coal mines. The amount of coal they are taking out of these coal mines is increasing at an alarming rate. Because of that, they thought coal supply would be abundant, the revised estimates because of continued coal extraction and all that, the Planning Commission, which is a central government agency which looks into these issues, has determined that the economically extractable coal reserve in the country can last for only 30 to 40 years from now onwards because of an increasing coal extraction rate. Now, because of large number of coal power plants coming up all over the country, there is a very strong demand to open up more number of coal power plants, rather coal mines, which would reduce the amount of coal what you hold under the ground in next 15 to 20 years or even, let's say, 30 years. But the problem, another problem is, almost all good quality coal in the country are below thick rainforests. Now, if we want to maintain a good quality environment, we need to have a good forest coverage. Now, the forest policy in the country, which was developed in 1980s, say very clearly, in order to have a good environment, the country need to have about 33% of its land area covered with tree and forest covers. Now, at present, this particular figure is less than 20%, which means 20% of the land is covered with forest and trees. Now, if a large number of coal power plants are to come up, you have to have more number of coal mines, which is not acceptable. So the people are strongly protesting that. And even those areas where this coal, rich quality coal are located, they are in the forest. And there are a huge number of tribals who are dependent in the forest are living. Now, if we want to have more number of coal mines, these people have to be displaced. There will be environmental problems, water supply problems. So there is a huge amount of opposition in India against coal power plants. At the same time, people are also opposing even cutting trees for opening up coal mines. So if you look at them in perspective, the government agencies keep saying that we need to open huge number of additional coal power plants, but we don't have additional coal mines coming up easily because of environmental reasons and people's opposition. So that is how government is now moving towards a situation where a substantial portion of the future demand for coal may have to come from imports. That's how these coastal-based coal power plants, which you refer to, they are planned to be dependent entirely on imported coal.
I was talking with the climate and energy co-director at Greenpeace International. She told me that some of the protests in India are about the amount of drinking water that coal plants take to cool themselves. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, you'd imagine because of such a huge population, almost all regions in the country are water-stressed. The fresh water is coming at a huge premium. As a matter of fact, in many parts of the country, the women folk walk for a few kilometers even to fetch a pot of water, drinking water for the entire family for the day. So a large, almost all provinces, there are about 30 provinces there, almost all provinces except in Himalayas, they're all water-stressed states. Now, we all know that these coal power plants require tremendous amount of fresh water for their operations. Now, we have about 70 to 75 coal power plants operating. With 70 to 75 coal power plants operating, if you have water-stressed population communities around, the coal power plant additional plant is about 600,000 extra. Can you imagine what would happen if all these coal power plants were to come on board? Where would we supply water to them? Now, some of the power developers say they will draw the required amount of water from ocean, they treat it and use it, but that is not entirely true because Even if you assume that about 45 to 50% of the planned coal power plants depend on the ocean, what about the other ones deep inland? They have to rely on the fresh water sources available in the country, and these fresh water sources are tremendously under pressure, and a large number of communities are not getting water, and more of these water supply is being diverted to industries, including the coal power plants. So obviously, you would appreciate that the people are up in arms against these coal power plants, which will demand much of the water resources.
How much of India's contribution to greenhouse gas emissions comes just from coal burning? Do you know?
Yes, yes. The Ministry of Environment and Forest in Government of India, it has come up with reports. It has a policy to come up with reports every year, and the latest reports say about 52% of the carbon dioxide emitted in the country can be attributed to the coal power plants.
And we're talking with Shankar Sharma, an energy expert on electricity from India. And I wanted to ask you, Shankar, nuclear power only seems to provide a tiny fraction of the generation capacity, but what about renewables? Are they starting to happen in the electricity field in India?
They are. They are taking off in a big way. We have to put that in proper perspective. Of the 177,000 megawatt of installed capacity, as you have correctly mentioned, nuclear power capacity is only 2.7%. It is a very tiny, and its relevance to power sector is entirely questionable. And coming from a power sector's perspective, as an electrical engineer, I feel nuclear power need not have any role at all in the Indian context. Now, coming back to the renewable energy source, to put it in proper perspective, whereas nuclear power plants have been blessed with huge amount of funding since 1950, their installed capacity is only 2.7% as of now. Whereas renewable energy sources, which took off in 1990s, about 20 years ago, without government's encouragement to a considerable extent, their installed capacity is already about 11% of the total power sector's contribution. As a matter of fact, to be correct, it is 10.4% as on 30th of June, as per the official statistics. Now, renewable energy sources, the entrepreneurs who are working on renewable energy sources, without waiting for the government's support and encouragement, they are doing their best. But in spite of their best efforts, the renewable energy sources are still a long way to go. We have huge potential. Being a tropical country, our potential in solar and biomass are huge, and India has a huge coastline of more than 5,000 kilometers from the mainland. If we also tap into the tidal waves, it's huge. And wind energy also is in a very huge number. I can give you some number as to what are the known sources, potential, and all that. What it says, the government's official information statistics say that wind energy potential in the country is in excess of 45,000 megawatts, and small hydros without major dams, they can contribute about 15,000 megawatts. And the biomass, that is agricultural biomass, is in excess of 25,000 megawatts. I think this is on a very conservative estimate. The real potential is much higher. The most important potential source of renewable energy for India would be solar. Being a tropical country, most of the parts of the country would get 300 to 330 days of sunshine. So you can imagine the potential there. The estimation is, the total energy that that can be tapped from solar energy is about 5,000 trillion kilowatt hours per year, as against the known requirement of total energy in the country, not but just electricity. If you convert all energy needs into electrical units, by 2050, the government of India is expecting that the total requirement is something like 5,000 billion units. But whereas the potential is more than 5,000 trillion. So you can see the huge potential there. There's a huge amount of solar energy and other renewable energy potential sitting there untapped And we believe, I am particular about that, that the requirement of electricity of the large population, remote population, can be met through decentralized renewable energy sources alone. So you can see the potential.
Shankar Sharma, are there particular groups who report on the Indian energy sector in English where our listeners could find news and reports to follow up? Someone you would recommend?
There are many of them. Greenpeace India has its own website. Now, Sierra Club is also doing well. They are coming out with periodical environmental portal reports. CSC, Centers for Science and Environment, is one website. They have their own website. There are many websites in the country who are reporting regularly on these areas.
Is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners as we wrap up?
Yeah, I have a fervent appeal that there are many countries like India who are very strongly in a disadvantageous position as far as energy distribution is concerned. So the entire international community has to engage these countries to help come up with policies which are people-friendly, environmentally-friendly, environmentally sustainable. And all these policies should focus on decentralized, small-sized renewable energy sources alone, not the coal power plants, not the dam-based hydro, certainly not the nuclear power plants. So the international community of students and the civil society people, we have to engage these governments, especially the governments in the developing countries, that the conventional power plants such as dam-based, nuclear, and coal-based have no role to play in meeting the energy requirements of the poor people or the disadvantageous people. And certainly they are not in the interest of the environment. So we have to move resolutely towards decentralized, small-sized rooftop or community-based renewable energy sources.
And I think we have to do the same thing here in North America, but that's just my opinion. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and it's been our privilege to talk with a longtime energy expert from India, Shankar Sharma. Shankar, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks to your audience also.
I would like to thank Justin Gue, and I hope I've said that correctly, Justin, of the Sierra Club India, for arranging that interview. Justin's last name is spelled G-U-A-Y. Google his work on the Sierra Club Compass online magazine to get up to speed on India's big coal rush, and find more links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Let's get back to Indonesia for a moment as the biggest provider of India's coal and the CO2 emissions that come from it. Indonesia has big coal reserves on the tropical island of Sumatra. These are undeveloped so far. Most of their big mines are in Kalimantan. They're part of the island of Borneo. The Indonesian government owns the biggest mines. Some they run directly, others they contract out. The largest private coal miner is Bumi Resources. That company has two subsidiaries, PT Artuman Indonesia and PT Kalman Prima Coal, called KPC. India's biggest corporate conglomerate, Tata, has purchased 30% of both these Indonesian subsidiaries. Tata has big coal-fired plants and more under construction. The mad rush to build coal plants for India would blow the mind of any misinformed Western person, because India is long past its own peak coal production. The country must import from countries like Indonesia and Australia. Coal plants require whole rivers worth of water for cooling in those big towers. But India, as we heard from Shankar Sharma, is already parched for drinking water. The only solution is to build new power plants near the ocean. Part of the electricity generated would be used to power desalinization plants, just to get cooling water from the ocean. That uses a lot of energy, emitting still more carbon before any power hits the transmission lines. Take the single state of Andhra Pradesh along the eastern sea coast. 63 coal-fired power plants, 8 times current production, 56 gigawatts of coal electricity is planned. In a country famous for corruption, environmental reviews and the rights of people already living in the area are thrown out the window. Seeing themselves thrown off, their agriculture and fisheries ruined, these poor people are fighting off the coal rush as best they can.
These visuals of a lush wetland in Sompeta turning into a battlefield catapulted Srikakulam into national focus last week. Two villagers died in police firing. When protesters tried to stop Nagarjuna Construction Company from fencing the land on which a 1320-megawatt thermal power plant was to come up, the government says there is no need for a judicial inquiry.
They said they are only putting a fence to these private lands which were purchased, duly purchased by them. And thus, that was grossly misunderstood by the general public. That's what they are claiming.
The locals say their stand has been vindicated with the National Environment Appellate Authority cancelling environment clearance to the project, saying there was misrepresentation of facts.
That report was from NDTV. Here's a bit more.
Policemen displaying their brute power to a group of villagers and fisher folk in Sompeta in Andhra Pradesh's Srikakulam district. The locals were protesting against the setting up of a thermal power plant in the area. With over 3,000 villagers from surrounding villages descending on the foundation laying ceremony of the plant, despite prohibitory orders in place, the police opened fire.
Tear gas open chesina kuda control gun paristhitulalo oke sari vilandaru vachi attack cheyadantone fire open chesina paristhiti vachindi.
Activists say the 12,000 crore rupees thermal plant spread over 1,800 acres would adversely affect the ecologically fragile Bila wetland area. Besides, they say the company was starting work without getting requisite environmental clearances.
Everywhere, all SEZs, all lands given to the industries are wetlands. That is why everywhere there is a conflict, people are fighting.
The situation continues to be tense in the Sompeta area. This even as a public interest litigation on the issue is pending before the Andhra Pradesh High Court that has issued notices. There is also a case pending before the State Human Rights Commission against the establishment of a coal-based thermal power plant in a precious water body. In Hyderabad with camera person Nagraj, T.S. Sudhir, NDTV.
The coal companies claim to occupy wasteland, but really it is thousands of acres of wetlands with villages and people living there and fisheries that are ages old, and they're being devastated. Meanwhile, Indonesia decided to raise their coal prices to meet international market prices. Suddenly, the cheap coal supplies for India are not so cheap. As we heard, one mega project has stopped dead in mid-construction. Another is only partly operating. The coal builders want to raise electricity rates, breaking promises. Consumers are up in arms. The government is dithering. There are signs this Indian coal plant building was a kind of real estate Ponzi scheme, with setbacks from public protests, court rulings, and escalating coal costs. Some projects are heading towards bankruptcy. This could damage or break some banks in India, whose loans to power companies rose 47% since 2009. Bank loans doubled. Another banking scandal is brewing in India. Will they ask for a government bailout as well? Most of Indian power generation comes from state government-owned operations. They will likely continue to try to satisfy public demand for more power. If they keep on with coal-fired electricity, we may all be fried by greenhouse gases. As we heard from Shankar Sharma, there are plenty of other options for India. Solar power alone has a much greater potential than all India needs. Lester Brown of Earth Policy Institute was on Radio EcoShock discussing the problems of crop tolerance for climate change. Rice, he said, was already at the top of its temperature range. Just 2 degrees added heating could threaten or end the Indian rice crop. India is also dependent on the monsoon rains, which can be changed along with the climate. Northern India and Pakistan depend on the regular melting of glaciers to feed their rivers. If those glaciers melt too fast, first you get floods and then an everlasting famine that strikes almost 1 billion people in the future. India depends upon our climate of the past millennia as much as we all do. Coal cannot be the answer. People in the West need to expand their view to see this problem. There is no part of the world which doesn't matter, not now. When I visited India, trains in the South were still running on coal. That was a long time ago. When I landed in Jakarta in the 90s, the capital, the mega city of Indonesia, there was a new reef along the shore. It was formed of all the human-powered rickshaws grabbed by the government and tossed into the sea. That was modernization under the dictatorship of the early 90s. There were two roads into central Jakarta. One was a new toll freeway, almost empty, except for the odd Mercedes. And below it, a constant traffic jam of the real Indonesia on the potholed free road. At that time, there was a Western-style mall downtown. Inside, there was everything you might find in Dallas, including a McDonald's. Outside, there were army men with machine guns to keep out undesirables, which means most of the population. There has been a big change since then. Indonesia threw off the worst of its censorship. The hated dictator was replaced with a new democracy. But Indonesia apparently cannot control the peat fires, sending dangerous bursts of carbon into the joint world atmosphere. They cannot control world record destruction of their tropical forest, apparently. Indonesia plans to flood the world air with even more coal and carbon by increasing coal mining, exports, and local burning. That is their national plan. What is our plan to deal with it? Global environmental organizations like Greenpeace and the Sierra Club have recognized the danger of just letting countries like Indonesia and India plunge into a coal-based economy without any other possibilities like solar or thermal or wave power. Both of these groups write reports you should read. Google them. Both help organize protests and work to empower the local people displaced and polluted to death by the coal industry. Sierra Club has organized a workshop to connect coal protesters in India with coal victims in Appalachia. We must support their work. But really, our plan so far is to remain ignorant, to pretend that what happens on one part of the earth will not affect us here, to pretend there is nothing we can do about it. Is that our game? To wait, to hold conferences, to make rules nobody follows until the climate is wrecked for all generations. I hope we can do better than that. We have all the renewable tools we need to forget coal, to leave it in the ground forever. Please join, become aware, become active, care, and act on your caring. Feel free to visit our website at ecoshock.org for more, download our programs and send them far and wide for free. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock. Some of our background music was created by Vast Mandana at SoundClick.com. We go out with Dan Mangan from his new album, Oh Fortune, How Darwinian.
In the cars, in the beds where they sleep, in the alleyway, behind the fast food chains where they eat. People don't know what they want, they just know they really want it. I should know better by now. It's only so to go around. Through a lens, like a dog at your feet, I will see the world the way that it seems easy to see. See, I don't know what I want, I just know I really want it. I should know better. So